first episode of what we are calling the Postural Restoration Podcast. I'm excited to welcome you on this journey with us as we discuss this science of postural restoration, particularly with those of you that are utilizing it in your daily life. We'll be hosting various different interviews, discussions on this platform, all revolving around the application of the science, and specifically, as I mentioned, how you, our listeners, are using it in your practices. Various professionals within our community, specifically this PRI community that is growing, have one way or another implemented this science and this approach into their treatment and training methods. And really, we're going to use this podcast to highlight you and how you do use that. As I mentioned, we're fortunate to have a growing number of PRI certified and trained providers throughout the country and internationally. Now with more than 250 providers, we are, you know, on a daily basis asked either by phone call, email, or various other ways, you know, who is in our area that we can see that has been trained by you guys, that's credentialed, and that is using your science. So, you know, we're proud to say that we now have over 250 providers, and that number is continuing to grow. In order to introduce these professionals and get to know them on a more of a individual level, we are now going to be using this podcast as really an outlet for those featured interviews that many of you have either been asked to or may have come across in the past on our website. So our featured interviews are now going to be, you know, audio recorded, and we are very excited to have numerous people, you know, on this particular podcast. The Postural Restoration Institute, as you know, has expanded over the years in many directions. We're coming up on two decades of this institute, and today, you know, I'm personally proud to discuss this expansion with you, and we're going to begin today really discussing in this first episode the foundation of the Postural Restoration Institute, which occurred in the year of 2000. It's particularly my pleasure today. I'm sitting here with the founder and director of this institute, Ron Horuska. We're sharing a cup of coffee here. It's a cold winter day, but I'm proud to not only be able to introduce him as the director of the institute, but also as my father. You know, with the expansion that has occurred and the growth that we've, you know, had the pleasure of being a part of, he has always somehow mentioned to put us, his family, as a priority. And as this PRI family continues to grow, I think, you know, we're both sitting here very fortunate to be able to watch it and support it together. So without further delay, we have the director and founder of the Postural Restoration Institute, Ron Horuska.
Okay, well, thanks, RJ.
So basically, we will kind of today go through, like I mentioned, the foundation of the institute, and really, you know, we're going to have an open dialogue here. As I mentioned, this podcast will be used for featured interviews and for multiple other discussions. Today, I want to basically take our viewers, Dad, here through a timeline of not only your past, but kind of the past history that led you to create the institute. So for our listeners, I'm going to start off with a little bit of background on you, mm-hmm. where you started, what, you know, your many years in the hospital setting, and then, you know, as we go through your history, we'll get to the foundation of this institute. Mm-hmm. As we go through this history, I'm sure you will all, you know, we'll all find out that he will have probably, you know, little bits and pieces of information that led to this foundation throughout his career. You know, your background is quite vast as you've been practicing now for over 30 years. Do you want to maybe just start with our listeners and kind of discuss with them, maybe let's just say post undergrad, so your graduate schooling through the University of Nebraska Omaha Medical Center. And really before that, your start in dental school as a foundation for graduate school, and then what led you to kind of be more involved with the physical therapy side of that.
Sure. And you know, I appreciate you doing this, RJ. I think it'll be good for all the listeners to hear, you know, this podcast as it grows for you. I think it's going to be good for the listener to hear how each and every one of the people you're interviewing have their own personal stories and backgrounds and contributions that have made us all successful. And I really like what you said about this family orientation, our family mindfulness, because I think it's one of the strengths of the Institute. You know, I'm not sure, RJ, how much I should cover. I think what's important maybe for the listener to understand that, you know, I got a bachelor's degree in life sciences with a heavy emphasis in biology and zoology, the same thing you have. And at the time when I came off the farm, you know, I was the oldest, I am the oldest of 13 kids. And at the time I had no idea really what I wanted to do. And, you know, I keep telling people I still don't. But back then I knew I loved anatomy and biology, and I applied to dental school. And when I started taking those dental school courses, realized how passionate I was about human anatomy. In addition to invertebrate zoology, I loved algorithms. I can't say I loved organic chemistry, but what I loved about it was there was a relationship, there was a template, there was a, you know, there was a certain process associated with looking and learning at how things interact. And as I reflect back, even on today, on where we're at and where we've come from, to this day, I look for those processes, those patterns. And so I can honestly tell you at the time, I don't know why some of those courses I took, you took, a lot of us take, we don't see application until later on in life. And I'm very mindful of that, and actually somewhat grateful. At the time I wasn't, because I took a lot of courses, as you know, that really didn't have a whole lot of meaning until you look back and think the meaning that they provided was short-sighted.
Yeah. One thing I think is probably worth mentioning at the start of this interview here is, as we prepared for this discussion here today, we pulled out this old file from 2008, and we're going to attach this to the podcast. But basically, you know, the attached file that we'll share with all of you goes over some of these foundational concepts and where he was at in his life while those were occurring. One of the things that is mentioned within that is, you know, while you were in dental school, and I'm trying to just find it here on this handout so that we can reference it for you guys. But while you were, you know, attending dental school early on through the graduate program, you started to notice that there wasn't necessarily the same symptoms or same observations on one side of the mouth as right. the other. So I was trying to find that in this packet, right, but right. It's in here somewhere that you noticed the bruxism or the differences between the left and the right mandible early on in dental school, which kind of led you to start mm-hmm. questioning. Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's true. And, you know, RJ, the thing about, so the audience knows, we just pulled this foundations of the Institute out today. I haven't seen this in years. So
we're going to update it a little bit and reshare it.
Yeah, Jen found this. It was written back in August of 2008. But you're right. I think probably the most in-my-face example of the word asymmetry came from that anatomy that I received both in pre-dentistry and in dentistry, in terms of looking at not only facial configurations, but things like diaphragmatic musculature that, you know, when we went through our anatomy in school, we look at things so quickly, and we, all of us, had an opportunity to, you know, dissect. And at the time, we're just trying to memorize muscles, we're trying to memorize what innervates them. And you're right, when I look at this, I think probably the thing that probably stuck out the most was this atypical organization that was seen through cranium torque, cranial configuration, just the facial appearance. And then you dig into it and you realize that you're right. Some of this occlusion has patterns that reflects our muscular activity of our neck and our breathing cycles. And at the time, like I said, this asymmetry I knew very, very little about. And the more I looked for it, the more I could not find. We didn't have, You know, we had the Dewey system back then. We didn't have what we have today. You couldn't type in a few words and pull all the stuff, pull this up on the internet. But I did find enough, and I was convinced enough that there's definitely some architecture in our body that's asymmetrical, and that is a gift in itself.
So at this point, I mean, you're still a graduate student in dental school, and I mean, I guess, what would you, I mean, besides the asymmetry, what was the biggest realization that caused you to transfer programs, I guess I'm saying, to switch from the dental program to physical therapy?
Well, actually, that was another point in my career where there was we all have mentors, RJ, and I had a mentor named Stan Harn, Dr. Harn. He's a professor of anatomy. He ran all the anatomy at the University of Nebraska Lincoln Medical Center for years in the Dental College. And I remember very clearly one particular week he said, you know, Ron, you're never going to make it as a dentist. And I was at that time a TA. I was doing a lot of work with the cadavers at night, putting them away, and I was paid for it, and I enjoyed it. And so I spent a lot of time around him and around these. We didn't have a lot of cadavers, but the ones I did have the opportunity to work with allowed me the opportunity to really find out this sincere interest that I have in system design. He was the first one that recognized it, and he said basically, you know, you're in the wrong program. I don't know what program you need to be in, but you're in the wrong one. And he did mention physical therapy, and I started talking to physical therapists. I applied to school that year, got in the next year, and I remember your grandfather, my dad, saying, I really am going to practically disown you if you continue to do this the rest of your life. And I said, Dad, I think this is it. Got into physical therapy school, and I remember I wrote a letter to my parents, your mom, your grandma, and grandpa, and I said, I think I still have that letter, and I said, Mom, Dad, I don't know if I'm still in the right profession, but they convinced me to stick with it. I'm so thankful I did, and as a result of that, you know, I was on my way to looking at this this whole perspective of design as it relates to musculature and neurology that I never dreamed would take me down the path that it has.
Well, and that path for, you know, in terms of coming to a close with your physical therapy degree, graduated in 1980 from the University Med Center up in Omaha. You know, you mentioned you really didn't have any real clue as to how you would use it. Did you know after graduation, you know, you had done some, I believe, some either clinicals or rotations through the VA Center up in Omaha? Mm-hmm. Did you have a job lined up? Did you know where you were going to be working?
No. When I got out of PT school, the day I graduated, the following Monday, I enrolled in a program at UNO. And the program I enrolled in was public administration because they had a health track for gerontology. And one of my mentors in Omaha, as I went through school there at UNMC, University of Nebraska Medical Center, one of my mentors was the director of the VA Medical Center Rehab Department. And his name is George Blanton. And George was the one that said, you know, when you get out of school, I was working during my summers as a physical therapy aide and worked a lot with Vietnam vets, my age actually. And I worked a lot with stroke patients and people that had diabetes and complications associated with COPD, a lot of CVA patients. And I love geriatrics. I just love gerontology. And I thought, well, maybe I'm in the wrong profession. I need to be working with the elderly. And so I got my degree in I got a minor in geriatric. I can't even tell you it was gerontology. I'm sorry. And I got my master's in public administration. And I thought I was going to run a nursing care home. I really thought that's what I was going to be doing in my life administratively. And being around George, I realized there's a lot more to physical medicine. It's psychological, it's neurological, and he was an expert at all that. And as a result of that, the VA medical program that I both had a job at, both as an aide and then after I got out of school as a physical therapist, allowed me the opportunity to continue to study the polyarticular muscle chains, synergistic tonic activities associated with hypertonicity and extremity difficulties, and things like Brunstrom and PNF and things I got in school actually had an application where some of the other programs I could have gone into would not have. So my second mentor, George Blanton, was the one that really helped me adjust my life as I was going through another program in life called public administration to combine that administrative background that I was getting through the gerontology program in the public administration program at the University of Nebraska of Omaha, and combine it with my physical medicine background and training, and then go into a field that I thought I could move forward in, and that would be looking at rehab medicine from a different perspective than we got in school. In other words, looking at how to integrate with other disciplines, which the VA does to this day so well.
Well, and I know we had mentioned prior to sitting down today that I wanted to particularly mention your time with the VA. In this packet that we dug out today from 08 that we shared with the listeners, there's a piece in there that really discusses the diaphragm and the realization of respiration really controlling, you know, everything that you now know it does. Do you want to highlight maybe just some of those cases at the VA that really made you aware of the body's ability to not only heal itself after these burn victims, but really the respiration piece that became aware to you?
Well, there's two things here. One is after I left the VA Medical Center, I did happen to work at the burn unit at St. Elizabeth's here in Lincoln, Nebraska, and I actually was hired to become the director of the physical, occupational, and speech therapy departments. And that activity followed the activity that did occur in the VA, which were related to dermis issues like burns and scar tissue deformation and diabetic complications. And so this whole field of dermis, this whole field of looking at how extremities can have an impact on how we breathe when they're burnt or when they're hurt or removed, did leave a lasting mark on me. And so I think that's one of the reasons I got my job as a director of St. E's PTOT department, because my boss at St. E's understood that I had that background at the VA in areas that they were needing management of in a private setting, a private hospital. So I did have the opportunity to look at equilibrium and balance and diaphragmatic activity. And as I did that, I love pedagogic reading. I read. I was around mentors who knew a lot about the respiratory system. Back then, there was a lot of chest percussion going on. Physical therapists were actually respiratory physical therapists back in the 80s and late 70s. They did chest percussion. We did a lot of diaphragmatic breathing. We did positional drainage. I had a lot of activity because of the type of patient I was working with, and guidance from mentorship that really understood how important it was to keep the lungs moving.
Well, and it's also mentioned in here, not only did you have the actual hands-on experience, but from all of my understanding is that the VA Medical Center up in Omaha really allowed you to first begin working with other professions, such as speech and prosthetics.
Yeah. Some of my closest friends, RJ, are, you know, I can name them, name names. Dennis was one of my closest friends in the area of speech therapy, and he was the one that showed me the importance of communication and how important it is for anybody who's, whether they have an extrapyramidal problem or a CVA problem, whatever their issue is, if they couldn't communicate, they probably weren't going to get better. And that requires voice, which, you know, we're having a symposium this year on the vocology, if you will, of how to produce airflow. And here I am talking about airflow with these experts from all over the world coming, and yet it all started in my mind back then with a speech therapist to remind me that, you know, vocal folds are really the resistance that your diaphragm requires for you to walk and get up and move. So Dennis was a big impact, had a big impact on me, and I'm so grateful.
Well, and not only speech, but, you know, like I said, with your public administration schooling, this was probably the first time in your life that you really kind of had that integration with all of these other professionals.
Absolutely. The VA gave me an opportunity to engage with a number of different professions, and honestly, probably some of them I would have been just fine in, because they were all there system-minded people that were working in a setting that required system-minded interaction.
As you mentioned a short while ago, after you brought up kind of the position that became available here in Lincoln, where we're currently at, through St. Elizabeth's Medical Center, also was a hospital setting. But as you applied and accepted this new kind of director role, you know, after having this hands-on experience with the VA center, if you had to just quickly choose something in your mind that was the biggest difference, I mean, what was the biggest cultural shock in terms of moving from a VA medical center to more of a, at that time, I believe it was a private healthcare system?
It's an insightful question, and I'll tell you why. I can recollect it very clearly, and it'll never leave my hippocampus. And that is, I was shocked at how much rehab, how much physical therapy depended upon rehab equipment, things like isokinetic equipment, Biodex machinery, Cybex machinery. You know, at the VA we had a plinth, we had parallel bars, a hot pack hydrocolator, and some assistive devices for walking like canes and crutches, and I'll tell you, RJ, that was about it. And then I went into this private hospital with, I think we had 20 some PTs and OTs, and we were, you know, I was working in a with a group of people who I deeply respect and learned a lot from, but they were really being implemented in a way that was completely different. The call was usually made by a referral from an orthopedic physician, heavily orthopedic driven. And I'll never forget the first time I worked with a knee patient and the emphasis that was placed on this thing called the patella. And I recall it very clearly how upset the orthopedic staff was, and that would be including the physical therapists and the physicians, that I was working with this patellofemoral issue that I really felt was a femoral patellar issue at the time, and how much resistance I got when I started to approach that patellofemoral problem by looking at hip musculature and respiratory states that required, you know, shifting from side to side. I'll never forget it. And so it's kind of one of those moments in your life, you go back and you think, today it's easy for us to go forth and think about things that are related from the proximal to a distal attitude. Back then it was so specific. Pain was driven by the site, not by the cause. And that probably was the biggest challenge for me, because I just left 5-6 years of working with system integration, and then I went into the specific non-integration field, and it took a lot, but I stayed there 15 years and we got through it.
Well, and this is not included in any of the documents, but I've heard, and you can maybe shed some light on a story that relates to this equipment topic. I believe at one point in time with the physical therapy center there, you know, it was brought up that you wanted to kind of redo the rehab equipment. And then that was a big, you know, just to get a new piece of equipment involved was like you had to clear department heads
any organization you go to, they have leadership that was, you know, that was very successful in the manner that it was being provided, because it was needed and it was well received, and there was definitely a cost benefit. I remember specifically, you know, looking at equipment that really at that time was not designed around just orthopedic activity. It was designed around neurological feed forward activity. And the resistance I got was not centered around the physical therapist necessarily I worked with. It was centered around just the disposition the country was in, the attitude the country had when it came to things like gait. And the need to get people to understand that you can't walk if you don't have arms that swing. So I fostered not only physical therapy, but occupational therapy and speech therapy. And as a result of that, we became pretty good at rehabbing our burn patients. And I'd like to think that our departments actually capitalized both from having a burn unit and also capitalized from the burn unit capitalized from our activities and what we were doing with those burn patients. We saw a lot of people that really got a lot of benefit from programs that were not generated around just an orthopedic mindset. And it showed me that the world could do this. We could look outside our scope of practices and engage other scopes. And it was really rewarding for me to see what we did in those 15 years with other disciplines.
Yeah. So you mentioned kind of this patellofemoral patella. At the time, no one knew what was causing what. And then in relation to this equipment standpoint, I want to kind of move on to, you know, if you could maybe discuss a little bit with our listeners what led you to further develop clinical tools and different, different pieces of equipment. You know, later it would be called protonics and different different things with the Inverse Corporation. But really this need or the drive to start considering other ways of using equipment and braces and things like that.
Well, RJ, I think what you're getting to is I had to make a decision in my life at that time, and I did this primarily for my patients, on how to get a patient to not only benefit and recognize and sense improvement, but be able to explain it to their loved ones so their loved ones and that patient could explain it to the physician or the other healthcare personnel what really was going on, because it was not, you didn't read about protonics in a textbook. Programmable resistance independent of speed and gravity. That's what really protonics is all about. And I put it on a brace-like structure to get the hamstring activated so I could show and demonstrate what registered new position, we called it repositioning, could actually do for not only all your appendages by being in a better state, but also neurologically what it did for your autonomic nervous system, what it did for your neck, what it did for your breathing. And I could go further, but I had to start somewhere. I couldn't go into the mouth and look at oral airway management by looking at occlusal issues. So that piece of equipment I couldn't do. There wasn't the acceptance for that. I couldn't really look at the visual system. It took years for us to understand what neutrality really means orthopedically. So I put together a system, a piece of equipment that went on a leg, but it wasn't really put on the leg for the leg. It was put on the leg for a system to regain control of laterality so you could move from one side to the other without restriction, both neurologically, physiologically, and even physical restriction. And just the questioning of what was going on with that application itself opened so many doors for me. And even if those doors could not be maintained as far as opening, a lot of people closed them as fast as I went through them. And the ones that did stay partially open, it generated the ability for me to start talking about other relationships and concepts. So it was a decision I made early on in life, pretty close to about where you're at in your life, that I said, you know, it's okay. If people don't understand this, that's okay. Those that do will keep their door open a little bit and we can move further along with that type of person. I just wanted someone to appreciate design, and not the protonic design, but the human body design that was not being looked at from a universal asymmetrical mindset.
Well, and as I hear you talk, you know, we're fortunate to say that now there's, I think we're up to over 600 non-manual techniques and a program for manual techniques and all these resources that are, you know, that the new to PRI person has available. Back then, you know, from a bird's eye view, the protonic system was really the first repositioning activity.
It was, but again, it wasn't necessarily the best. Later on in life, RJ, I created some pools. We created these pools to help people understand what flow will do to your body, reposition you. I'm working with an optometrist to this day that looks at how to reposition people by using the acuity and the visual system. Repositioning using frequencies.
Yeah.
It goes on and on and on. But back then,
but as a starting point,
that was the best way. And as I reflect on it, I still think we'll look back in life and we'll think it was probably an appropriate starting point. You had to get enough people to appreciate a hamstring, and it's a two joint muscle, and how it impacted our pelvic floor and the way we breathe was in my mind a very important novel concept to get established.
Yeah, really the only, the reason I want to spend so much time on it is because one of the main purposes of this discussion is to move on into the foundation of this institute. And I've had discussions with other faculty that have been on board for years, and in some ways they all come back to this protonics unit that allowed you mm-hmm. to at least have the discussions that were needed to further these concepts. So I don't have it in front of me. Were you able to use this brace in the hospital setting, or did you develop this protonic system after stepping away from the department?
Well, I first of all, and I respect your RJ a lot by calling it a brace. It was put on a brace-like structure, but a lot of people did just that. They called it a brace, which is why I had to leave the hospital setting. They familiarized the apparatus that went on a leg as a brace, and it's such an orthopedic community. And when I say that, it still is to this day. Orthopedics is not a bad thing; it's a great thing. But we tie so much to our orthopedic background that sometimes we're forgetful that there's a neurological, an autonomic. There's so many other systems going on at the same time that can have an impact on orthopedic program design and outcome. And so you're right, I got to the level where I actually, we went through a number of prototypes, and before we actually went into our final first product, I knew I had to leave the hospital because it would never be well received, in my mind, like I wanted it to be received. I invested a lot. Your mom and I poured some savings into this, and we said, if we're going to fuel this thing with sweat and tears and our money, we need to probably, and we didn't have a lot. We said, the best way to do this is, get out of the hospital setting, start your own company. And I did with another gentleman named Frank. And Frank and I put this company together. And for 2 years, all we did was research and design. We did a lot of discovery. We did research and design. And it was fun. I enjoyed doing it. I think, I don't know how many prototypes we put together and are still using yet today. But that allowed me to get into the private. I mean, I went from public to private to another private entity, and a business that allowed me then to really create another opportunity, and that was private practice, where in private practice, I had the opportunity to do what I was doing in those years of development and design and carry it out clinically.
Is there any other, so as you mentioned, this was kind of a 2-year-ish point in your mm-hmm. life of developing this repositioning device? And again, the reason I spent time on it is mostly because of other people's, this is really a tool that allowed a lot of other people to come on board mm-hmm. in these early years.
Yeah.
Do you want to mention kind of the earliest forms of courses that were taught about this? Mm-hmm. I'm assuming this was a point in your life where you hadn't, publicly taught a lot in front of people. This probably allowed you to do so?
Well, during this time, I was really, because of my administrative background, I was really active in the American Physical Therapy Association. I was a member of the Federation Board of I helped design the Model Practice Act with Blair Packard and others. Your dad was really involved in the political scenery of the profession. And even the legal scenery, I was on the judicial committee for years. I was on our board of examiners here in the state of Nebraska for a number of years. I really engaged into as much practice-based modeling that I could get myself into, because I want to know how insurance worked, how the laws worked, how our profession worked. and who were the leaders. And I got around them and spent a lot of time. I was youngest president of the chapter, and I think I still was the youngest one. And with all that being said, during that time, I cornered myself into a situation where I had to find a distributor, not only to distribute the use of the equipment, but to give me an audience as I was staying active in the associations that I just mentioned. So at that time, we used AMPI. An AMPI manufacturing company helped move this product. During that time, they, as well as I, needed faculty to teach how Protonics was put on and used. And that offered me the opportunity to meet people like James Anderson, right? You know, James was a student at the University of Nebraska Medical Center when I first met him. And people like Mike Cantrell and Jen Poulin. That era was an era where AMPI was, I think Mike and James actually taught courses for AMPI.
Yeah, correct.
I believe, anyway.
And that's kind of why I circled back to it, is I've discussed kind of the same time frame with now our faculty members that got to know you during that time. Both of whom, for sure, as you mentioned, James Anderson, and later on Mike Cantrell, through James's mentorship, mm-hmm. kind of recall tracing their involvement with the Institute back to these you know, AMPI courses,
right.
and teaching courses on this Protonics device.
Right.
So really, you know, you look at a date as a foundational date of our Institute in 2000, you know, this AMPI and this Protonics device would have been occurring several years prior to our foundation here at the Institute, and really set the stage for what would come.
I think James and Mike took a big hit in their careers. I mean, James wasn't even out of school, and he understood the word pelvifemoral versus femoral acetabulum or patellofemoral. And James really gave me a means to teach, because just the discussions and the dialogue that I had with him not only allowed your dad to feel comfortable with himself, but allowed others to hear dialogue that they've never heard before. So James is a blessing, and he always will be. We could talk probably every bit of this longer about him. Mike, on the other hand, had his own practice. When I met him teaching a course in myokinematics years ago, he was so curious and so driven by the concept that was more along the line he was really driven by the concept that position is such an important thing to consider. So when I look at When I hear Mike, I think position. Mike was in a position in his life where somebody repositioned his mindset, and that was James and I. And then once he got on board with that position, he was the one that helped us really go further down that rabbit hole and then look at cause and effect, or effect and cause. And so, you know, having now two people on board just really opened the door up for your dad to even go further with these PRI concepts.
Well, and interestingly enough, in my memory, these years are probably the earliest I can remember of PRI. Before we get into kind of the foundation of the Institute, I want to take a step back. And at this time, as you were still working with AMPI, you mentioned kind of the door opening for private practice. And, of course, started the Heruska Clinic, I believe, in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
So really, having that freedom to not only, you know, I think you went through a couple different, as anyone does, a couple different spaces and different growing, you know, spurts of growth, mm-hmm. and moving from one location to the next and hiring and you know, trying to build your practice. As Heruska Clinic, you know, became kind of a stable entity, I can picture it to this day. You know, one of our directors by the name of Janie Ebmeyer sitting in a single room in an old Heruska Clinic building, kind of starting to put together these early these early thoughts of the Institute. So I don't know if you want to highlight any of...
Well, I'll comment on a few things, RJ. One is this Institute has always been based off of clinical design and clinical application and clinical experience. And even though we really are mindful of what's going on by doing literature reviews and reading and looking at evidence-based activity, there are people in the past who felt that this was not an evidence-based institute and still is not. But in reality, everything we have put together in our manuals is based off of clinical evidence-based activity. So I try to make sure that we never would be put in a position down in the future, that is, to say that back at that time, back in 1999, where was the evidence for this? We have so much evidence behind the science. It's not science that I created. It's science that I extrapolate from other sources. And those sources are all based around clinical design, clinical application. So all of our faculty members have been, are, and always will be deeply and grossly involved with application of clinical programming. Whether it's PRI or other designed teaching, it still comes down to, are you applying it? And I can honestly tell you, there's no way we would have started this institute prior to me being in my own practice. So we started the Heruska Clinic. I hired a lot of osteopathic trained. In fact, my first three PTs were osteopathic trained physical therapists.
And one of them is still there
with us. And that osteopathic mindset allowed me then, and with their support, people like Jason Mushik's been with me from day one. His ability to endure this processing and support your dad, he's like a son, he's like your brother, is so important to recognize that without that family member, as we talked about earlier, without those family-minded men and women, I wouldn't be where I'm at today, you wouldn't be here, and we wouldn't have this beautiful institute. So that's why 1999, my wife, your mom, and I knew that we had to start a clinical practice where people respected our work. And we still have that practice going on today with a lot of respect for what we do as a family. Now that allowed us then, again, another benchmark, another template to work off of for institute design. And the first two courses, the mild kinematic course and the posture respiration course, were all designed around clinical material that came out of that clinic. To this day, a lot of our techniques were being done with and by and are presented through those clinical experiences.
Well, and it's interesting as I hear you discuss this clinical kind of setup that was started. All of the directors in PRI, Janie, Bobby, and Jen, and yourself have all started in that clinical setting. So we mentioned Janie. Started in the Heruska Clinic, and now our director, Jen, that's here on a daily basis, started as a PT as well in the clinical setting. Do you have any comments or just a quick story, if you will, regarding kind of that decision to say, hey, Janie, I need you to start kind of focusing on this material and putting mm-hmm. together these courses,
right?
Basically pulling someone away from the clinical side to basically formulate what would later become our coursework.
Well, Janie's a physical therapy assistant. She later got our business. She got her business degree as working in this institute. But Janie's number one gift for us was exactly what you said. She made sure that your dad and this institute was going into a direction where consistent evidence-based correlations and discovery with our patient biomechanical, respiratory, neurological, functional patterns that we were seeing were carried out in a manner that were predictable, that were functional, and did not limit us. And so she was consciously and constantly reminding us when we were going beyond those boundaries. She would
and
sit
still
there,
does.
And still does that today. She just did it yesterday. And otherwise, we wouldn't have reproducible outcomes, and our outcome-based programs would not be respected. So the work that I was doing, along with people that I clinically practiced with, that would be those wonderful PTs across the street, and the mentality that people like Bobby and Janie and Jen still to this day have, allow us to always reflect on consistency. And that reproducibility, that consistency, that non-variability, if you will, in terms of outcome design is why we're so successful where we're at today. All of us are clinically minded. Janie specifically gave me the opportunity to move in directions that I was doing, looking at unnatural approaches, novel approaches, and yet keep me grounded, keep me in the boat, because there's many times your dad was way out there. And she pulled me back and say, you know, we're not ready for that, Ron. I remember specific trips back from courses that we were putting on. And she'd say, now, Ron, I'll tell you what, next time, consider this. And make sure that you don't forget about this. And be mindful of this. Janie is an absolute blessing. And honestly, for this institute, where we're at today, we would never have gotten here without people like that.
Yeah, definitely. The other, so you just kind of mentioned this replicable, you know, ability to reproduce outcomes. You know, without outcomes that are reproducible, you don't have a science. So this kind of leads me into the idea of discussing kind of, you know, I don't know if you're able to, if you remember or not, but when you were putting together these first courses, and actually it was called Postural Restoration at the time, before it was respiration, postural restoration and myokinematics, you had to have the tests and the outcomes. So what clinically, I mean, you mentioned it was an ongoing thing, but clinically, if you can kind of highlight how you came up with or what led you to do the tests in the way that they are written today, basically how you made it replicable.
Okay. Well, it's a very good question, and again, I'll try to do that in a very short amount of time. The tests that we use to this day in the Institute are reflective of the mindset that I had to be in at the time that I felt they were important to introduce. Humeral glenoid, for example, internal rotation, is not owned by the Postural Institute. It's not something that we trademarked or, you know, it's just a reflection of internal rotation. Now, relating to respiration is huge. A hip extension is not something that, you know, it's a Thomas test in the orthopedic field. Adduction of the leg is an Ober test. I took tests and took the name Thomas and Ober and dropped them off and just called them extension drop or adduction drop or internal rotation to get back to the phenomena or theory, which it's not. It's not phenomena. It's not theory. It's realistic. It's replicable, as you said. And that reproducibility is going to be either limited or unlimited if you put people in the right state of position or the right state of neurology. And so I had to select RJ tests that were somewhat graspable. You could grasp them. You could nurture them. It was your nature because you had an education of biomechanics or anatomy and biology. It was something biomechanically, it made sense. And then you tie it to a physiology and an autonomic system of design. That's when people get real greasy. And so having tests that could tie you from one world to the other world was instrumentally, clinically very important to your dad. And I still to this day reflect on hours of thought put into, should I put this test in this institute? And what would be the reasoning why? And narrow it down to a group or amount that we can all look at repeatedly. There are so many different tests out there that we could look at, so many different things like heart rate variability and autonomic testing and so many tests we can look at. But the ones we selected for each one of these core courses are tests that will carry this institute way into the future. And I'm proud of the fact that we've got this far, and every test we've introduced is still being discussed today as an important discovery for every patient we work with. Because without those tests and looking at those tests in the manner that we do, we wouldn't be able to make clinical decisions like we are right now to this day. But it was a challenge, and I'm really, really, I have very little regret on the tests that we've selected based on the time the timing, the country, where the country was, where the clinic or the clinicians were, to this day, we're not that much further ahead. We still have a very solid base community of people that want to know relationships, and we should. We should always have that need. So I picked tests that I think represent a community that wants to work better together with different disciplines, different mindsets, and it's still around today.
Well, and as you know more than I do, 20 years later, you can look back and say, you know, yes, they may have been tweaked or changed, or we put more emphasis on this word rather than that word, but the tests that you used in those earliest years now are still the tests that are allowing all of those multiple professions to, you know, they're utilized across the board, and they're not owned by just physical therapy or just athletic training or just chiropractic.
No, they're not. No.
So the way those tests were set up, not only was it right at the time for you in physical therapy, but now looking back, it's allowed them to be utilized interdisciplinary. When we think of these other disciplines, I kind of want to, before we wrap up here today, if you will, kind of a full circle in your career, you're now, you know, spending more and more time in these other areas because of because of the science and its use in all of these areas. What's the biggest excitement you have going forward from where we are now to other areas of airway and you mentioned autonomics and heart rate variability and really the foundation of the Institute allowed us 20 years later to have these discussions about these other areas.
You know your dad well. I'm looking at my career and how grateful I am for having the time on this planet to explore with the help of others patterns. And patterns is a word that's in my name. I'm a pattern-minded person, as you know, RJ. And when I look at what we have here to work with in the areas now that is applied to things like extrapyramidal disease or dysfunction like Parkinsonism or just the word tremor. When I hear the word tremor and imbalance and equilibrium issues and vestibular issues and issues associated with autonomic function, this last course that we just put together, I just finished up, called Cranial Resolution, is exciting to me. I've been waiting over 25 years to give this course, RJ. Your dad is, as you know, is so excited about it. And I've given it once, and I look forward to giving it many, many times. I was telling Jen and the directors yesterday, we may have lower numbers in attendance to some of these courses because they're going to be more related to the neurology of behind things that are very well researched but have not been clinically yet actually applied in some way. So things like vocal cord dysfunction and the influences that our head and neck and throat and spinal column have on the way we react and interact with gravity and ground forces and pressure, it's so exciting to me. This spring symposium, I am so excited about this ability to talk about the importance of the ability to talk about it. That's what I'm getting at. The ability to
25
talk about,
years later.
Yeah, the
to
ability
be able
to talk about this and have people maybe show an interest in how our diaphragm stay strong by the word vocalology, vocal course. So overall, I'm excited about what we can now do with other disciplines and other fields that we should have been doing years ago, but obviously there's a time and a place for everything. And I like to think that this institute is going to be an institute that's going to be existing way into the future as a leader in that area, pulling interdisciplinary mindedness together with specialists in these disciplines that have more expertise in certain areas than one, but yet have so much to offer if we would collaborate our activity. We've always collaborated, and now we actually have the ability to collaborate even at a higher level, and that does excite me.
Yeah, I know. Again, obviously, it's you know, we look at we look at these kind of PRI principles and the mission of PRI and what the Institute stands for. When you hear the word interdisciplinary, you know, every year now we have a symposium to pull different professionals in. As you mentioned this year, airway oscillation and voice mm-hmm. production. In the past few years, we've been able to, you know, collaborate with airway specialists and dentists and
optometrists,
myologists, and just keep naming them. Really, for me, it's, as you mentioned, the most exciting thing, because not only did you create these tests and these courses 20 years ago for physical therapists, but 20 years later, they're now being, you know, utilized and used by all these other professions.
And, you know, the thing about that, that really makes me makes me very happy, that would be the best way to say it, is that each one of us in the areas of rehab medicine, each one of us have wonderful attributes, wonderful histories. You know, the chiropractors have a great history, osteopaths have a great history, physical therapists have a history. We all have these great histories. And as I look at how we evolved, the common language between all of us is this thing called respiration. And when you put it all together, this postural restoration institute is built off of that common language of how to breathe. Whether you like yoga or not, whether you like talking about apertures, things like noses and mouths, and whether you like to talk about frequency generated by teeth or by sound and on the floor and the ground that we hit with our heels, whether you like to talk about appendages that need to swing and move, whether you like to talk about things like abdominals that are really important for strength and purpose, all these things are related. All of them, take any subject, any discipline, any history, any career, and we all have one common language. We do one thing well: exchange air. We exchange it. We breathe in and we breathe out. Now, if we didn't do it well, we'd be dead. We can do it better. A lot of us can do it better. And the way you do it better is by collaborating system design. And so this institute is taking a serious approach. Airway management is not new to this institute. It's the dentist approach to looking at occlusion on how it changes airway management. It's not new to this institute. But what's new to the world is this institute's application of all that. And I, as we wrap it up, RJ, I'll tell you the thing that excites me the most about all these disciplines, all these symposiums that we put out in the past and are going to continue to work with in the future. Looking at that, you know, looking at our friends like Dr. Hinden, and looking at people that we've met in the last few years as it relates to oscillatory activity and management of our body by ourselves. The one thing that still to this day I'm so thankful for is the ability to pull in this respiratory cycle and manage it. And this will not go away. This is an asymmetrical design system. And when you say the word asymmetry, you know, people are going to think of PRI. And when you say the word, you know, apposition, they'll think of it PRI. And when you say the word neutrality, they're going to think of the word PRI. But it's not owned by a discipline. It's common language.
Yeah. And really, as you mentioned, there's not one discipline that can benefit more than the other from respiration. We all, you know, what is it on average, 20,000 times a day?
Mm-hmm. 22,000.
So yeah, being able to not only have common tests, common concepts, common coursework, but then to be able to pick any area of the body or any subject matter and relate it to the breath. I do want to highlight, so just to kind of mention some upcoming things for you and for this institute, we speak of respiration and different ways to look at it. You will be, you know, kind of joining this chiropractic group coming up this March and doing some presentations with the ACA Rehab Council. You know, and we're excited about, you know, collaborating more with chiropractors. We have a faculty member, Skip George, who... you know, is a big part of that. that's exciting coming up in March. As you mentioned, the new cranial course that's allowing you to kind of get into more of these autonomic topics and central nervous system drive and different things related to that. Spring Symposium coming up in April with the voice and voice production. So all sorts of new collaboration and integration coming up. Is there any other, you know, besides what's occurring in our future here within the next year, is there any other comments or, you know, words you'd like to say relating to the future, you know, just within the year to come or anything as far as your excitement?
This year, I think the biggest highlight of this year will be the symposium. I'm really excited about this and the symposium coming up, RJ. I'm excited about the affiliate program. We have a person that's going to be, I think, outstanding when we talk about pediatrics. Lisa Mangino will do a great job with James on that. I'm excited about the affiliate program in general, you know, what that program has to offer us in the future. I'm excited about the people coming in to hear the symposium, but then the day after that we have, you know, I always enjoy that day after by listening to the talks and presentations put out by PRCs and PRTs on areas of interest that each one of those people will have, and I always look forward to that. I'm looking forward to certification. I think one of the things we really are going to work hard at, we may even give some scholarships out this next year on people applying for certification. But certification is exciting to me. And you've been here during those events where we have people coming into the Institute, going through the certification process. There isn't a better time in our life here in Lincoln than that time. We bring these people come in, they get away from their family, they come in here, it's intense. It's just a wonderful time for us to get to know our family, those people on the wall, those certified, you said it earlier, the providers that are out there. We have two kinds of providers. We have the providers that are certified, we have those providers taking courses that are learning a lot because of application of Institute design and techniques. But those providers that have gone through the certification process excite me. And it, no matter when you would ask me that question, whether it be in the beginning of the year, the end of the year, the middle of the year, I always look forward to the certification process. And I think, you know, as you know, it's once a year for the PRCs. It's twice a year for the PRTs. Hopefully, we'll have that same thing going on this year. And we just had a meeting yesterday that probably is the biggest excitement we've got going on in this country. Now, in the area of international activity, Japan is just booming. You of all people could talk about it. In this interview that we're having right now with your dad, I can't tell you how excited I'm about that family. That family has been strengthened by people like you and Jen, and we have a wonderful faculty over there. That group of people really, they embrace us, and they are really doing some neat things in that cultural environment that's a little bit unique, but yet very similar. And so I'm excited about Japan growing. I'm excited about going to Germany this year, teaching a course in Germany. You know, Mike has laid the ground, James has laid the groundwork in countries like that, and Germany, I think, is growing. So the opportunity to grow international foundation activity is also exciting. So as you can see, there's a lot of things going on. We're even, you know, as recently as today, we're looking at 2020 in terms of what kind of course materials do I want to present with, and where do I want to present. I'm excited about myologists. I'm excited about speech therapists. And this Chiropractic Association meeting coming up, RJ, I'm really excited about that. I think the combined section meeting this year, again, had a big impact on our profession, the physical therapy profession. I really believe physical therapy is going to continue to welcome this institute as we continue to grow. And I think the reasoning behind it is going to be self-sustained. It's self-fulfilling. It's so profitable. It's so good for the association from many directions. So there's a lot to be excited about, and I wouldn't know where to stop or start, but I think you can see the passion coming out of me.
Well, and, you know, you mentioned the credentialing. We, you know, I can be proud to sit here next to you and say we have, you know, over 200 PRCs, as we mentioned, 50-some, you know, getting closer to 100 PRTs. You know, we just talked to Jen right before this. You know, we have over a dozen course opportunities, whether that be affiliates or primary, secondary options. And I did want to mention that to this day has in some form or the other taught or hosted 35,000 attendees.
Really?
So whether that be repeat attendance or new attendance, as we sit here today, the Institute of Postural Restoration has taught in some way or the other 35,000 people.
Is that 35,000 people or 35,000 course attendees?
Course attendees. So course that attendees. They could have repeated.
Right.
But,
okay.
But 35,000 course attendances from 2000 to 2019 today.
Arjun, that's impressive.
So congratulations and thank you for taking the time today. As I mentioned, I'm going to be doing this with we're going to start with faculty, and with this interview today, we're excited to post several others. All of his information can be found on his faculty page. You have, you know, several publications. You've been mentioned in several different articles, research reviews, you know, whether you have spearheaded those or been a part of them. We're continually updating people's, you know, provider information, faculty pages. You know, you're working with people continuously as we speak to write future articles and future research. And provided any of our listeners have any interest in that, you're welcome to contact Jen. And if you have any, you know, speaking opportunities or you'd like, you know, Ron's involvement with any research or anything along those lines, you're welcome to reach out to Jen or I. Again, we will supplement this episode with the document here that we referenced several times. Thank you for listening. We're very excited to start off this podcast series, and I welcome you back. Episode 2, we will be interviewing James Anderson, so we mentioned him a few times today, and we'll hear his story in the next episode. So thank you very much. Thank you, Dad, for spending the afternoon to discuss these foundation concepts. If you're interested in learning more about the Postural Restoration Institute, you can visit our website at posturalrestoration.com. You can also email me directly at info@posturalrestoration.com or follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter to see how PRI Nation is currently applying this science. As always, thank you for listening, and I look forward to having you on our next episode.